Welcome to the first session of the morning. My name is Ido Flato. This strange accent that I have is because I come from Israel, where I work as an architect and as a troubleshooter for a local consulting company. And for the next 45 minutes, we're going to talk about debugging, but not just debugging, because any developer can open Visual Studio, open their code, put a breakpoint, and start debugging the code. I'm going to talk about production debugging. Debugging the systems where you can't actually attach a debugger and press F10 to step over your code, okay? We're going to understand what it means to do production debugging, and what we're going to actually do for the next 43 minutes is to go over stories that I have from troubleshooting code at customer sites. I'll tell you the story, what we found, how we troubleshooted the code, and of course, what the bug was and how we fixed it, okay? So just before introduction, funny story that happened to me this week. I flew here on Sunday morning, and Sunday morning, just before I boarded my flight, I got a message from one of my colleagues who was at the company. And they said he said they have a web application that usually works, but at some point, sometimes the worker process goes up to 3 gigabytes of memory and just stays there without going down. So, you know, I'm suspecting memory leaks, maybe some issue with high rate of allocations. So I asked him to add a small piece of code to do garbage collection, and then run it so it will run a garbage collector and then create a memory dump and send it over to me, okay? So we did that, and just before I boarded my plane, he emailed me that when he executed the garbage collection hanged, okay? Just got stuck. So I had my suspicions. Anyone guessing what my suspicion is? Why would a garbage collector hang? Yeah? Something in finalizer, you're actually correct. Yeah, unfortunately, I don't have a gift to give you, a prize or something. Come to me afterwards, I'll give you one of the swag from the expo. Something with the finalizer. So I got the memory dump when I landed in Istanbul for my connecting flight, hooked up to the internet, downloaded the dump file, downloaded all the PDB files, debugged it actually on the plane. Okay, using a tool called WinDBG, we'll discuss in a couple of minutes. And I actually noticed, just like that gentleman said, a problem with a finalizer method. Okay, and as you might know, if you went over the theoretical content of .NET, if something is stuck in the finalizer, the garbage collector won't run. Any object that is allocated won't get deallocated properly, at least not those that need a finalizer, because there is a single finalizer thread. And if your code is not running correctly, and by the way, that's the code that they had wasn't their own code. It was from a third party, which I won't mention its name. It's some sort of a queuing system, not Microsoft. But it just hanged and caused the memory to go up to 3 gigabytes. We checked the code. We found out exactly what happened, and now they are in the process of just disposing the objects during the execution of the code and not letting the finalizer run its course. Okay, so if you dispose an object properly with a using clause or just calling dispose or close, then finalizer won't execute. And that was just flying in to Ignite. Okay, so imagine what I have to go through in a day-to-day basis in customers. So we're going to talk about bugs in applications. We're going to understand how to code better. I'm going to forward some tips at you on not just what the bugs are and why they happened. And of course, I'm going to discuss the tools that I'll be showing. 45 minutes is not enough to deep dive into the tools, so I'll give you a scheme over the tools, show and tell. But mostly, you'll just have to go back to your office afterwards and look into those tools and start using them. Okay, so I'm hoping that by next week, everyone will go to the office, download the WinDBG or Debug Diagnostics, which I'll show later, and other tools that we'll see. So how are we going to do this? I'm going to tell you what the client reported, what they noticed. Okay, that's not necessarily the bug, that's the symptom. We're going to see the steps that we used in order to troubleshoot the system and the tools that we used to do that. Then we're going to see what the bug was, how we fix it, okay? And then after each story, we'll discuss the tools that we use. Sometimes it will be two tools, sometimes it will be six tools, okay, depending on the story. So let's start. First story is the Tired WCF service. So this is a local bank which I visited. Don't worry, it doesn't have any international branches. You won't see the problem occurring on your end. And what they reported is that they have a WCF service. How many people are using WCF? WCF? Quite a lot. So WCF service can handle a lot of requests concurrently. What they reported is that at some point, the CPU goes very high. Requests are probably being handled. But what happens is that additional clients that are trying to connect can't connect. They are waiting for a very long time. And then they are throwing timeouts on the client side. And even though there are no clients actually currently connected to the service, they are still seeing a high CPU coming up from the process. What they did, this is an IIS-hosted service, not a Windows service, so they just restarted the IIS application pool. Of course, the CPU got down and then started again after a couple of hours. Okay, so each time they noticed that, they just did a recycle of the pool. So the first thing that I wanted to check is to verify that the high CPU is actually coming from WCF, from the operation itself, not from some side code, side thread that is running in the process. So how many of you are familiar with performance counters, Windows performance counters? Okay. So performance counters allows us to check the amount of memory that you're using, the CPU. Performance counters allows us to check stuff in .NET, such as how many exceptions you have, in WCF, how many calls are currently executing, okay, how many locks and threads you have in the system. A lot of information that you can produce from performance counters. So what we did is we enabled performance counters in WCF. We added that setting that you can see that shoots out performance counters on the service level. So each service has its own set of counters. And we went into Perfman, that's the name of the process that executes performance monitor, and we chose to use the counters for WCF. For some reason, they are not called WCF. They are called service model service, just like the name of the WCF assembly. And we chose two specific counters, the one that shows how many instances, meaning how many objects of your service that are currently running, and the percent of max concurrent calls. How many people are familiar with the max concurrent call setting of WCF? Max concurrent call, okay. So first of all, look at the bottom. WCF actually throttles your system. It doesn't allow all of the incoming calls to execute. It actually throttles them to a default setting that you can change. The default setting is 16 times the number of calls that you have. So for example, on my machine, I have four calls, so I can execute up to 64 concurrent calls for WCF. The 65 will get hanged until one of the other calls will finish. Now, of course, you can change that value, but they didn't change that value. So what we noticed is that the number of instances that I had was actually 65, and the percentage was 100%, or to be more exact, 101.563. If you calculate, that's actually 65 divided by 64, okay? Because it wanted to show you that it's not a situation of exactly 64 running. There's one waiting, okay? So that gave us a little pointer about what's going on, because the situation is that clients are currently not connected, but the service calls are still running underneath the hood, okay, in WCF. So if anyone ever executed code that runs forever, they know that even though the client stops communicating with the service continues to run the code, okay? So we got that from Perfmon. Now we wanted to see what kind of code was actually running in there. So we used the tool from a suite of tools called sysinternals. How many people have heard of sysinternals? Great, great. So we used a tool called Process Explorer. And Process Explorer is basically Task Manager on steroids, Task Manager plus plus, that allows us to see not only the list of currently executing executables and device drivers in the system, but also allows us to see .NET stuff. So we can see the threads in the process. We can see the managed code that is currently executing in each and every one of the threads. And we can see, of course, information about the executable, the strings that it has, the DLL that it got loaded into memory. We can even see .NET performance counters that are specific to that process. Let me just show it to you on my machine. So this is Process Explorer. Can you see that on the back, or should I increase the font size? Can you see that? Yeah? OK. So let me just take this W3WP process, which is, of course, the process for my application pool. And let me just cause it to use a bit more CPU. I have a special link here that just hangs the CPU. OK, so let me just increase this. So as you can see, I'm using almost 100% CPU currently. And if I'll double click, oh, it just got closed. Let me just run this again. OK, so as you can see, I can actually look at managed code right now, and I can see that this code uses thread sleep. OK, so using Process Explorer, we were able to actually see what was going on in the process and realize that this process had a lot of threads running in it, but each thread was doing some work, small piece of work that took about 1% of CPU. But if you multiply that by the 64 threads that were executing, the CPU got to around 95, 98%. So we checked what kind of code was executing there. We just double-clicked the thread, got the call stack, as you can see in the screenshot. We noticed that it was running inside some strange loop that tried to do something, didn't manage to do that because some external service wasn't available, and then it just tried to do a retry. Sleeping, retrying, sleeping, retrying, but it never actually succeeded on doing what it needed, so it never actually finished running. Okay, so we showed that code to the developers. They fixed that, and of course, we didn't hear from them back, of course, except for the paycheck they had to give us. So this is the first story, the first issue that I wanted to show you. As I mentioned before, we used Performance Monitor, which allows us to view information about the running system, about running processes, information about CPU, memory, disk, network, but not only about hardware, but also about software. We can see information about our databases, about our .NET applications, whether it's .NET desktop application or WCF or ASP.NET. I can see a lot of CLR information, such as locks and security checks and file access, a lot of information that I can use in order to diagnose the system. The second tool that we used is Process Explorer. Process Explorer, as I shown you, allows us to see not only which executables are currently running, but also which threads are currently running in the process, the call stacks of each threads, and if it's a .NET process, we can also see performance counters and view exactly how many garbage collection the process did and so forth. The next story is about volume tests. How many people are familiar with load testing, volume testing, stuff like that? OK. So this was not a development team that called us. This was a testing engineering team that called us. They had an MVC application that they needed to test. And it tested successfully. They load tested it to check how it works under request stress. And it actually worked. But then they did volume testing. Volume testing is basically taking the application into its 10th year, imagining how many items will be in the database after 10 years, and then loading the system, okay, just to see how it will actually work if it had a whole lot more data in the system. And then it crashed. Okay, we started to see HTTP 500 messages, which is internal server error, nothing specific that we realized through the messages. And they called us in order to investigate. So the first thing that we did, we wanted to look into those HTTP 500 messages. So while they were testing the system, we just opened the browser, opened up Fiddler. How many people are familiar with Fiddler? Oh, cool, great, great, great. All of you who didn't raise their hands, install Fiddler, unless you're not web developers. Okay? If you are web developers and you don't have Fiddler, then you're probably, I don't know, JavaScript developers? Okay. So we looked at the response message. There was no information there. It was just an error occurred while processing your request, nothing very informative. So we went on ahead to check the server side. So to check the server side, of course, Event Viewer didn't show us anything. So what we did is we used IIS failed request tracing. We couldn't have used IIS logs because IIS logs will just show us the HTTP 500 being sent back. So we configured IIS failed request tracing. How many people ever did that? 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, about 10 out of about 200 people sitting here, which is better statistics than I usually get when I talk about IIS. Failed request tracing basically takes the concept of .NET tracing, the thing that you can send trace messages in .NET code, .NET, ASP.NET, MVC, Web API, WCF, doesn't matter. Everything in .NET sends trace messages. And IIS just picks those up and saves them in an XML file, a separate XML file per request and response. Okay, so you can actually see all the tracing information from all of your modules in the IIS pipeline, all of your handlers, all of your .NET code. You can see them in one place for each request. It takes a whole lot of space, but it's very useful. In that case, they had a special exception filter in the MVC code that allows us to write to the trace file, because by default, MVC doesn't write to a trace file. Web API does, MVC doesn't. So we turned that on. We added the IIS trace listener, so it will pull those traces and write them into that file. By the way, if you are looking for IIS failed request tracing in your machines, it will be under any kind of application or even on the main website. Just scroll down, you'll see failed request tracing. Okay, if you don't see that, this means you didn't install the tracing part of IIS. Okay? So open that, and you can go on ahead and add rules here to trace messages. Of course, there is no 600 status code. Just didn't want to figure out what was the last status code of 500 and something, okay, instead of writing 599. So once you do that, you get trace files that look like so. Okay, this is a trace file. And if I go to, say, compact view, as you can see, there are plenty of messages here coming out from the IIS pipeline and from your code, stuff like which handler was picked, information from ASP.NET, information either MVC, Web API, from the IIS pipeline itself, a whole lot of information, including, of course, errors that are relevant for our debugging session. So what we did is we turned that on, and we waited for the application to start responding with errors. And this is what we saw in the file in that compact view. An exception, finally an exception. If you can read closely enough, you can see that this was because of a serialization problem with JSON. So of course, we did what every developer does. We went into a search engine that I won't mention its name because we're in a Microsoft conference. We searched for the phrase in the exception. We got to Stack Overflow, which is OK to mention that. We saw a solution there. We copied that into our system. And of course, it didn't work. Because that solution doesn't apply to MVC, it applies to the same serializer being used in other scenarios. So what we did is we just opened the code, the source code of the JSON of the JavaScript serializer, and we noticed that marked part of the code there that checks the length of the output. Output is basically just a string builder that contains all the JSON structure, and it just checks after the serialization if it's not too big. Okay, so the question was, how big is too big? We wanted to be able to configure that in order to allow our code to be serialized without getting the exception. So we went on to the JSON result of MVC. Of course, to view that code, we didn't go into the Microsoft open source, I think it's called reference something website that shows all the .NET source code. We just opened a decompiler tool like JustDecompile or ILSpy, opened the source, and viewed the content of the JavaScript serializer and the JSON result object. And for JSON result, we actually saw the code that you see here that checks if I passed through MVC, through my controller, the value of the JSON size, it would have taken that and added that to the serializer. Without that, it just used a default value. Okay, so of course, we found the default value through different debugging ways. We checked the source code, and then we checked dump files, and I'll show that to you in just a minute. But what we just thought is, well, let's just set that max JSON size to a very large size, 1 gigabyte, 5 gigabyte, okay? Just to be able to, you know, serialize everything. But then, of course, something hit us that if you are serializing large objects, that might affect our memory. Allocating large objects is not that good. It uses large object heaps. It can make our memory fragmented. We didn't want to do that. So we wanted to first understand how big were our strings. So to do that, we needed to get a dump file of that running process, of one of those strings, to actually figure out how big it is. And this is where we decided to use a tool from Microsoft called DebugDiag, short for Debug Diagnostics. And this tool allows us to hook up to a process and grab a memory dump under defined circumstances. So we wanted something that happened during a crash. A crash doesn't actually mean a crash that crashed the process. It can be a hang. It can be an exception. Okay. So we used the crash one to get something because of an exception, to get the dump because of an exception. We wanted to point to a specific web application, to a specific application pool, so it won't just look for that exception in all of our executables. We selected the pool, and then we selected the exact exception. Now, the exception was invalid operation exception, which happens everywhere. So we just added the word JSON, so it will look the word JSON inside the exception message. Okay, if it sees that, it will take a memory dump. And that's exactly what we did. And we got a memory dump. And then we had to open it somehow to figure out what the value of the string was, okay, how big it was. And what we did is we used another tool called WinDBG, Windows Debugger, also, of course, for Microsoft. So how many people are familiar with WinDBG? Okay. How many people ever used a console to write code? No one, right? We use IDEs. But WinDBG is a console-style application, so brace for it, okay? It's not going to be easy. So first, we needed to check which thread had the exception. So we used the threads, the threads command and got a list of threads, and voila, we saw that thread number 23 had an exception in it. So we went on ahead to thread number 23 and checked the call stack. Okay, and the call stack showed us exactly where that exception was found. It was found in the serialize method. We actually knew that already because we had the call stack from the original exception in the IIS thread request tracing. But what we wanted to see is the actual objects which were used in that call stack. So as you can see, this is using a string builder. We saw that also in the source code. So we used another command called dump stack objects in order to see the objects in the stack. Okay, structures, objects, and so forth. And on the top, we saw that string builder. And WinDBG is an option to show you the properties of each and every one of the objects and structures that you have in your memory dump. So we just did dump obj, or DO. And we got both the string builder, and we also checked the JavaScript serializer itself just to see what was the size of the string builder and what was the maximum size that the serializer allowed us to use. And as you can see, the serializer allows us to use about 2 megabytes of strings, but the string builder had a 4 megabyte string in it. Okay, that's why it didn't work. So we didn't need to actually increase it to 1 gigabyte. It would have been suffice to increase it to, say, 10 megabytes. Okay, so they did that, and of course, the problem never returned. Okay, but they did have to warn their developers that they do have an issue with volume testing because they're probably passing strings that are too large and they will have to handle them on the client side. Okay, but that's the client side problem. I'm a server guy. So which tools did we use here? I mentioned Fiddler. Fiddler is basically an HTTP proxy, HTTP and HTTPS, that allows you to see the traffic flowing through your computer, anything that is HTTP based. Okay, it's a really, really great tool. It's free. I actually talked to someone from Telerik yesterday, and they said it's going to remain free, so no worries. Although we did hear about the same stuff from other tools that were free, and then they started to request paying for them. Second one is IIS Fed Request Tracing. That is free because it's part of IIS. Fed Request Tracing, as you saw, allows us to take trace information and just put it in an XML file. It will become very big, about a couple of hundreds of Ks on your disk. So don't just put everything there, okay? Make sure you're storing no more than the last, I don't know, 100 last requests or something like that. But it's very useful and it can allow you to debug stuff that happened in the pipeline itself. Because when you debug code, you actually debug up to the end of your method. You're not debugging into the pipeline of, say, MVC, Web API, IIS, okay? Fed Request Tracing sees all the information from that pipeline. So it is really helpful for that part. The other tool that we used are decompilers. You can choose whichever decompiler that you want. ILSpy, JetBrains have their own decompiler. Telerik has just decompile. Those are free tools. That's why I mentioned them there. Of course, you can also find tools that you need to pay for, which maybe offer some other benefits. But basically, everyone just grabs a DLL file, grabs the IL from the DLL file, and show it to you as C# code, VB.NET code, whichever type of language that you prefer to use. Okay. The second set of tools that we used were for dumping executables into a dump file. First one was Debug Diagnostics. As I mentioned, Debug Diagnostics is a tool that can actually do a lot of stuff. It can take a memory dump of applications that are currently crashing. So if you have an application that you know that crashes often and you need to catch it exactly when it crashes, that's where Debug DR comes in. It can actually also hook up to performance counters and, for example, create a dump file whenever your performance counter is above a certain threshold. So for example, if the CPU is over 90% for a minute, grab a memory dump and then, I don't know, shut down the process or something, recycle it. So Debug Diag is one tool. By the way, Debug Diag is a second tool that is Debug Diag Analysis, which actually takes that dump file and analyzes it for you, shows you a whole lot of of content in an HTML page, which threads got exceptions, which objects take the most in memory, and so forth. Okay, that's a really great tool from Microsoft. And the second tool was WinDBG. Now, if you don't like debugging dump files in console, Visual Studio is also able to open dump files, okay, ever since, I think, Visual Studio 2012. But WinDBG is preferable because it allows you to see a whole lot more stuff than Visual Studio. Visual Studio has a nice user interface. It shows you the code better. Tomorrow, actually, I'll have a hub talk where I'll do some live debugging with dump files and Visual Studio, so you can come and see. I'll get to a slide later on showing when it is. So these were the tools that we used for this case, okay? And by the way, some of these things like the WCF that I showed before takes about, I don't know, half an hour to diagnose and find the issue. These kind of things can take half a day. The finalizer issue took me an entire day to, you know, track down the problem and loading all the modules and such. The work of a debugger is sometimes 1 minute and you find a bug, sometimes it's 2 days until you find it, okay? But finally you find it, or you just format the hard drive and start all over again. Last story for today is a story about .NET memory leaks. If you found that .NET doesn't leak memory, it does, but it's not .NET that leaks memory, it's your code that is leaking memory because of your bugs, or a third-party bug that you know, put in your code. And the story here was a local insurance company. Again, in Israel, don't worry, your policies are just fine. And they had a web application where the employees of the company can view all the policy files and all the scanned documents that people send over to the insurance company. And what they reported is that along the day, the worker process memory is increasing again and again, and they reach up to about 4 or 5 gigabytes in size. No, wait, that was an 86-bit processor, about 2.5 gigabytes. And then didn't understand where it comes from. And what they did is they just increased the frequency of the IIS auto-recycle. How many people know that IIS actually automatically recycles your processors once a day? Okay. So just so you'll be able to disable that if you're not leaking memory, if you go to IIS, to any one of your application pools, and right-click and select Advanced Settings, you'll see that there is a setting here called Regular Time Interval, okay, 1740 minutes, which basically will cause IIS to recycle in a different time each day, okay, because this is just a strange number that will suddenly recycle application at 9 a.m. and the day afterwards at 4 p.m., okay, which is a whole lot more problematic than recycling it in a specific hour in the day, because that way it can't actually know why your application suddenly behaves weird, okay? My suggestion is, if your application is not leaking, remove this setting. If your application is leaking memory, doesn't have to leak a lot, but you know, even a small amount over time is not that good. So just remove this setting and, zero here, and then select the specific times and say, for example, recycle my application at, 7 a.m. before people come to work, maybe 9 p.m. after people go home, okay? And that way, you won't have to recycle the application during the workday, interfering with people's work, because you recycle stuff, sessions go away, people are logged out of the system, whole bunch of weird stuff going on. Okay. So let's get back to the slides. So we started troubleshooting the system. And first thing that we had to know is this leak native or managed? Because if this is a native leak, I'm not the guy to troubleshoot the system because I'm not a native debugger. Native code is C++, of course, C++. And I had to call someone else if this was the problem. So the first thing I had to do is check if it's a native or a managed memory leak. So I used a tool, another tool from sysinternals called VMAP. Now, I won't be surprised if no one raises their hands when I ask, has anyone ever used VMAP? Okay, so 4 people out of 200, which is nice statistics. VMAP basically just shows us a breakdown of the processor's memory. It shows us how many space is occupied by image, which are modules, DLL files of such, stuff that belong to the native heap, to the managed heap, private memory, and so forth. And we just took 3 snapshots of VMAP along the road. And can you notice if this is a native issue or a managed issue? Let me just pinpoint, okay? This was a managed heap issue, so I could stay and help them debug that. If not, I would just have let them call our CTO and he would come in and assist. So at this point, what we understood we had to do is we had to go ahead and, you know, just grab a couple of memory dumps from the baseline, and then after 10 minutes, after 20 minutes, and then just compare them, okay? So we did that. And to take memory dumps like that, we can, of course, use debug diagnostics, as I showed before. There is an option there to take a memory dump every couple of seconds. You can set that. But I just want to show you a different way, and that is using the Windows Task Manager. Okay, so if you open Task Manager, go to the Details tab, right-click a process, you have the option to create a dump file. And that will basically just create a DMP file in your temporary folder, and you can grab it and debug it on your own machines, on the server machine itself, wherever you feel like it. So we did that a couple of times, and now we had 3 different dumps that we had to compare. Okay, now, in WinDBG, it's a bit hard to compare the number of allocated objects. So we went ahead and used Visual Studio 2015 for that. Now, this is not part of the built-in debugger of Visual Studio. This actually requires the Visual Studio Enterprise Edition. don't know how many people here have Enterprise Edition. Oh, so you're fine. Usually, you know, people either buy the MSDN Professional or Ultimate, and those that have Professional whine to the managers that they want the Ultimate because they want to do more stuff. So if you want to be able to debug managed memory, not just managed code, you need the Enterprise version, okay? So we did that, and we opened up the DMP file, and not just one, we actually opened one and then compared it to the previous one, okay? If we look again at my machine, I have these dump files here on my machine. So I already clicked the debug with manage memory. I already clicked that because it takes about a minute to load all the symbol files from the internet. It just downloads everything to my machine. And I can go into the managed memory, okay? And I can just look at the current state of the memory, but I can also compare it to a baseline. And it takes a couple of seconds to load the dump file and to compare all the heaps together. I'll take this brief sip. Come on. We have like 10 minutes, so we have time. Although I do have it on my slide. Oh, it's comparing. Yay. Okay. And as you can see, it shows us exactly how many objects were added or removed, how much we increased in size. Okay, I can drill down to those single objects and see exactly each and every one of them and see exactly what it contains and how it's rooted. Root means which object contains a reference to our suspect, okay? So for example, a static variable usually contains references to leaked memory, okay? Because it's just hanging in static and no one is able to clean that static object. So let's get back to the slides and we see exactly what we found for these objects. So we saw that there is an object called dimut file. Dimut, it's in Hebrew, it's for imaging. And we clicked that and we actually saw that the object itself contains a byte array. A dimut file is basically an image, so it contained the image as a byte array, okay? And they did some image processing with it in the background. So as you can see, it just leaks for some reason, okay? People are using the system. They're probably entering the page, leaving the page, but the memory still remains. Of course, garbage collection always kicks in, but memory still remains. And we wanted to know why that happens. So we went on ahead and checked the roots of those objects to see who is pointing at those objects. And we noticed that they were pointed by a cache object. Cache single is the object that holds the ASP.NET application cache. Are you familiar with the ASP.NET application cache? Okay. The situation here is that the developers wanted to cache the image. So if the employee looks at the first file and then looks at the second file, they wanted it to be available to him quicker if he wants to return to the first file again. Okay, not to wait for it to go all the way to the database to pull that file again. So they just cached it into memory, but they never released that from memory. Okay, so the cache just got bigger and bigger and bigger, which ended up exploding the process. So we told them, of course, first, don't cache large objects. Second of all, if you do need to cache them, put some kind of an expiration on them. Okay, the ASP.NET cache supports expiration, whether it's a sliding expiration, expire in 10 minutes, or a fixed expiration, say, expire at, midnight. Okay? So just put something that will actually remove items from the cache when they are not necessary anymore. So we did that, and it worked well, but we did notice some other weird stuff going on, and I'll just go back to this slide. Can you see some other object that shouldn't be here? Can you see that? Okay, let me just go to the next slide and I'll point it out. Why is the MVC controller being leaked? I mean, this is a controller. A controller is created when the request comes in and usually disposed when the response is returned to the client. Okay? Garbage collector should pick that up and just clear it for memory. I actually don't remember if a controller is disposable or not. I don't think it's disposable. But it should just get cleared after a couple of seconds, milliseconds even. Okay? But it didn't. And as you can see, it has the same number of instances as those leaked objects. So something is connecting these both together. So we wanted to check out what's going on. And we went out and checked the root of the controller, just like we checked the root of that demut file. And as you can see, it's pointing to the same cache object. I mean, they are caching files, and they get the MVC controller being also cached. What's going on? As you can see, it's cached under something that is called cache item remove callback. So we went to the code to see how they are adding stuff to the cache. And this is what we saw. HTTP context.cache add, and notice the last parameter that I'm passing into the method. The cache object has an ability to notify your code when an object is being removed from the cache or updated in the cache or added to the cache. So they added a callback to get that information. They wanted to know when an item is being changed in the cache. But that callback was a void. Okay, meaning it's an instance method. And what they didn't realize is when you hook up to an event or to a delegate and you hook up an instance method, the instance itself, the object that contains that method, cannot be removed from memory. Okay, because it has the delegate has a pointer to the object itself. It's a part of the object. So in here, the solution was quite easy, just changing that method to static. In that case, they didn't have any kind of instance-related code in the method. They didn't check any instance variable. They didn't do anything. They just wanted to know if the object was released in order to put a trace message. Okay? So they changed that method to static, and of course, both the file and the controller just went away. Memory remained at a normal level, and the leak was gone, at least that leak. Okay, they had a few other leaks that we also diagnosed afterwards. You get rid of one, you see another one. That's how it works. So the tools that we used here, we used VMAP, which is a great way to diagnose memory issues in order to first figure out if it's a native or a managed, and if it's managed, why is it leaking? Is it a general Gen 2 garbage collection issue? Is it a large object heap issue? VMAP will actually show you the heaps and which designation they have. Are they large object heap or just a general Gen 0, Gen 1, Gen 2 generations of the garbage collection? We used Visual Studio Managed Memory Dump to diagnose and compare memory snapshots, which is a very cool way to compare objects in the memory. There are, of course, tools that you can buy from other companies that provide the same experience. Only those tools don't provide the ability to open dump files. They have their own way of creating dump files. Okay. So, of course, these are not the only tools that I use. I use a whole set of tools in my day-to-day work. But we have 45 minutes, and not an entire day, so I won't have time to go through all of them. So I use stuff like process monitor from sysinternals. I use a whole lot set of logs, IIS logs, HTTP logs, event viewer logs. Dumps usually use either debug diag or Visual Studio or, of course, sysinternals pogdump, which is a command line for creating dumps. I use sniffers that are not just Fiddler. I also use network sniffers like Wireshark or Message Analyzer for Microsoft. I actually had a theater session yesterday. I showed two other cases where I showed some of those things. You can probably catch those slides on Channel 9 after the conference is complete. So how do you start when you go back to work next week? So first of all, you have to understand what is going on. Is this a memory leak? Is this a hang? Is this a crash? Is this a 100 CPU usage? Okay. First, understand what is going on in the system. check it with stuff like Process Explorer, stuff like VMAP to understand what's going on, okay? Be sure you're able to reproduce the issue, because when you can't fix the issue and you have to call someone, you don't want that person to sit for the entire day to wait for that problem to occur, okay? So be able, you're able to somehow reproduce that and not just making me sit down and wait for it to happen. And of course, when in doubt, Marko Zinovich always says, when in doubt, use process monitor. I say, when in doubt, create a memory dump, okay? That will at least make us realize what went on in the process. But if you can, create two memory dumps. This is better than one, because we can compare, okay? Regarding resources and links, you had links throughout the slides. I hope you took some screenshots. If not, the session, of course, and the recorded video will be available online at some point. I'm also available tomorrow. I have a hub talk in the expo where I will show some real-time debugging, production debugging. And if you have your memory dumps, I know someone is going to talk to me on Friday and they have a memory dump they want to show me. So if you have a memory dump and you don't want to pay me, so just come to meet me at the Hub Talk and we'll try to find out your bugs. I actually had a session in London a couple of months ago, and someone brought not a dump, but he brought the HTML analysis of debug diag, and we were actually able in 10 minutes to find their bug. It was an issue with an IOC container that they used a singleton instead of using instances or something like that, and we found their bug in 10 minutes. Okay, so if you have something like that, bring it on. We'll take a look. Other talks, later on today in the afternoon, there is a talk by Marko Zinovich. If you're not familiar with Mark's work, Mark is currently the CTO of Azure, but he also is the creator of SysInternals. He wrote most of the tools in SysInternals. Okay, so we will discuss a lot of the tools of SysInternals. And tomorrow, there's a talk that I actually don't know what they're going to show, but there is a talk about debugging tips and tricks for .NET developers. I'm not sure if they're going to show Visual Studio mostly or production debugging, but it's going to be fun. In any way, thank you for joining and enjoy the rest of the conference. Thank you.